Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Bring yourself back online.
No one knows what I'm thinking.
Tell us what you think of your world.
This is just a cheap trick.
Some people choose to see the ugliness in this world. The disarray. I choose to see the beauty.
Welcome to Still Watching Westworld, an unofficial podcast about the HBO series Westworld. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
Each week we'll break down the latest theories, baffling questions, and hidden illusions, as well as occasionally chat with someone who has worked on the show itself. This week we have a very special guest, actor Jeffrey Wright, who, I don't know, plays Bernard and or Arnold and or Bernard-olds, depending on what you're looking at. But he graciously spoke to us about this big, very big revelation for Bernard / Arnold in this episode. That conversation will come at the end of the podcast. But first, Richard and I are going to discuss and only spoil up to season 2, episode 7, Les Escorchés. Did I pronounce that correctly?
I'm going to say yes, because I don't want to try to pronounce it. So, yes, perfect.
Okay. Les Escorchés, directed by Nicole Castle and written by Jordan Goldberg and Ron Fitzgerald. This was as frustrated and sort of disoriented as I was feeling after last week's episode, and Jeffrey Wright talked to me a little bit about that frustration and disorientation. I really liked this episode for the clarity that it provided, and I felt sort of like the ship was righted a little bit. What did you think sort of overall of this episode, Richard?
I mean, I liked it. I thought it was pretty, you know, muscular and sort of hard charging. Like it didn't really, there weren't any moments of kind of quiet introspection. I don't think even when like, you know, Bernard was talking with Ford and like, you know, and a lot of people like almost died, which was kind of crazy. So it was an interesting midpoint episode.
Yeah. And it feels like, not to keep referencing a conversation you'll have to wait a little while to get to, but, you know, I kind of asked Jeffrey Wright about like whether or not he felt like this episode changes the stakes of the show entirely with, you know, something big that happens at the midway point of the episode. And I think it kind of does, kind of doesn't, but we'll talk about that. But it's so funny for given that we didn't really know what the cradle was kind of until last week, the fact that it's gone now feels like a very big deal.
Yeah.
So here today, gone tomorrow. But let's start at the beginning. We start in the sort of modern day, present day storyline with Luke Hemsworth's character Stubbs going up to Bernard and being like, buddy, let's get out of here. These Dulles people are kind of crazy. I've had a conversion. I don't really support what they're doing. There's a satellite phone, sort of, I think, or a satcom, whatever device in Teresa's office. So let's go get it. And then, you know, it winds up they get nabbed and taken down to the underground lab that we saw last season. And something that I just never thought we would see, which is the revisitation of the Teresa death and Bernard having to sort of reckon with what happened there a bit more. What did you think of this opening?
Yeah, I was a little confused about like when we were, you know, yet again.
Yeah.
Feel like it jumped right into Stubbs's kind of like change of, you know, policy or whatever, mm-hmm. which in kind of a disorienting way. But no, I think that I like that they, you know, I like shows when they remember their history, you know, and this just shows me about that. And so going back to Teresa, I feel like was like a big part of that.
Yeah. And then we get this next revelation, which sort of is echoed and mirrored from season one, where like they found that underground lab in the first place because of a door, a hidden door. And this happens once again. There's a door behind a bookcase and we find another like a secret cabinet inside the secret lab full of a bunch of hanging Bernards.
Yeah, that was a creepy image. That must have been weird for Jeffrey Wright to see or like do, you know?
Right, yeah, he talked about that too, but like he, this is an image that was in the trailer for the season, so I know like a lot of people knew it was coming. I don't know that it was clear from the trailer that Bernard would be there when the discovery was made, and so yeah, for him to sort of stare down, he obviously already knows he's a host, but to be exposed in this way and to stare down, I don't know, yeah, this like just in your face representation of how fake you are. is like a huge reckoning. For me, and I could be wrong, but for me, this answers the question of like, what was Ford printing down in the lab downstairs? Maybe not, because like, he already had a functioning Bernard, so maybe he wasn't printing a functioning Bernard. But back in season one, when they were down in that lab, there was a body being printed down there. A lot of people thought that was like a fake Anthony Hopkins. You know, he's printing another Ford or something like that. But
Making Bernard, yeah.
It seems like he was just in the business of making Bernard.
He really likes making Bernards.
Who doesn't?
Yeah.
Who wouldn't?
Yeah.
What a lovely face. Then we flash back forward in time. Or no, we're still in the modern storyline. Sorry, I too am lost.
Yeah.
Charlotte is interrogating him now that she knows he's a host, for sure, and trying to figure out where the Abernathy, she calls it like the control unit, the mind egg of Abernathy has gone. And then we get a flashback. And most of the rest of the episode takes place in this flashback.
This is what I found confusing. Yeah, because I kind of like, I feel like I missed the some sort of like, shift or indication, and I was like, wait, weren't they just doing this, and why, you know, I just was because it for going right from Charlotte to like past Charlotte
was
kind of disorienting in a way that I found frustrating, but like again, maybe I wasn't like as dialed in or as I should have been or something.
Yeah, I think the only thing we have to distinguish ourselves between the two timelines in this episode are, or one of the main things we have is the character. I mean, leave it up to a Sarsgaard to be the key to it all. Like, Gustav Sarsgaard's character, Strand, is in the modern storyline.
Right.
And then the Irish guy, Coughlin, who gets his face punched off, is in the flashback. Yeah, so, like...
You called that last week. You were like, I think this guy's not going to be around for a long time. Like, they're going to... They introduce these flashy characters and then dispatch them pretty quickly. And indeed, they did.
Yeah, in a dramatic fashion. But yeah, we get... So we flash back. So this is like... I think it's like just a few days previous or whatever. And it's all sort of colliding. And in this episode, we talked, you know, you pointed out last week that a bunch of storylines sort of come together with that explosion that happened at the end of last week. Like, oh, we know that Bernard and Dolores and Charlotte are all in this at the Mesa and on the same storyline. And this week we also get Maeve brought into that same location. So we're all our storylines except for the Man in Black. Well, no, because he's connected to Maeve. That's all brought together on the same. We all know where we are and when we are, except for this like frame narrative of the Gustav Sarsgaard Strand storyline. But yeah, so we flash back to just a couple days ago, Charlotte, who's got Abernathy nailed to a chair. And I think we neglected to, you know, in a season of a lot of Jesus imagery, I think we neglected to talk about what it means to have someone nailed to a chair.
Yeah.
but that's the thing that happened. And Stubbs and Charlotte are protecting him, and Dolores and her crew invade the Mesa. And you've got this nice little like bait and switch where you see a pile of naked bodies and you think it's hosts, but it turns out it's humans, and the hosts are in the black gear.
Which means we get Teddy in this kind of like G.I. Joe, you know, all black kind of ensemble and stern face. It, even though he was very serious, it looked like I felt like James Marsden was having fun. Like, it was kind of like, we're playing army guys, you know?
I'm not kidding you, Richard. This is the number one thing I wanted to talk to you about in regards to this episode.
I'm glad that we're on the same trajectory.
We're
with
on
that.
Brand.
Yeah.
Yeah. Later in the notes I have written, Marsden is very hot in his Delos gear.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, he's got murder face on the whole time. And, you know, we already saw Teddy with murder face in the last week's episode. But this week you add the like black flak jacket or whatever. And it just like the whole look is complete. So, yeah, a lot of murder.
And when he has murder face, he it accentuates his jawline in a way that it's like, how does he have that jawline? So, yeah, I think he was having fun. I was having fun. I mean, despite the indiscriminate killing, good for this and more of it, please.
Yes. Then we hop over into the cradle. We know we're in the cradle again because like the aspect ratio changes on the episode. So when we're in widescreen letterbox, we're inside the cradle. It also, you know, we're in Sweetwater. We see last week we saw sort of Dolores and Teddy in there. This week we've got Clementine, like original crisp curls and not much of a rind on you, Clementine.
Yeah.
And Maeve in the Mariposa. And that's kind of like fun and disorienting. I don't know. What did you think of that?
I found it a little bit like melancholy in a way, you know, like, oh, right. Simpler times. Even though obviously Maeve and everyone else were like repressed robots or oppressed robots rather.
Right.
You know, but it was still kind of like a funny sort of sad, like harkening back to past.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's you see that and you're like, oh, this is how Sweetwater's supposed to be. And then you have to remind yourself like, no, this is like a terrible, yeah, oppressive cycle that they were all on. Yeah, it's a weirdly incongruous sort of sight. But we get Anthony Hopkins, and like as frustrated as I was to see his return in last week's episode, when I was like, oh, motherfucker, Anthony Hopkins is back. He's so good at delivering these speeches, and you're just like, yeah, Westworld missed this. I think it really did. Like, what was your thoughts on that?
I felt the exact same way. You know, like there's just this, when Westworld, when the writing gets all, you know, poetic, like he just speaks that better than anyone else. The timbre of his voice, his weird kind of cadence, like, you know, He just nails it, and it's soothing and creepy at the same time, which is sort of like kind of like the broader experience of watching the show, which is really entertaining, but also like gets into your brain a little bit. So I like you was sort of like, okay, I don't like when they just like resurrect characters, you know, that they had sort of declared were definitively dead. But in this case, I, you know, it actually works for me.
I know exactly what you mean about the cadence. It's just like the Welshiness of his voice, you know, mm-hmm. and you're just sort of like, yes, yes, I want to hear you say everything about Westworld. And so he sort of explains a bit of what we already knew, which is that like the way that Westworld exists, it's not to further develop the AI of the hosts. It's to use the host as a control to examine and scan the cognition of the guests and to copy over the human consciousness onto, you know, whatever, another CPU. But Ford says, like, you know, their experiment doesn't work. He says something really lovely, like, they've copied humans over like a soft-headed boy humming a tune that someone else composed. Like, you're just like, thank you, Anthony Hopkins.
Yeah.
You
mentioning the Welsh thing now has me wondering if they should get Catherine Zeta-Jones for season 3.
Of course,
more Westworld poetry in Welsh. Or in a Welsh accent, anyway.
Yes. And The Americans is over, so why not let's get Matthew Rhys over there.
Okay.
Some Michael Sheen, like bring all the Welsh people over.
Are we slowly turning this into Torchwood? Are they going to go film in Cardiff?
And or Welshwood, Welshworld? Yeah, Torchwood, great show, very sexy. All right, so so he sort of explains to Bernard something we already had kind of put together ourselves, which is the point of Westworld, that it's an examination of human consciousness. And he also points out, you know, and then they do this thing that they did so much at the end of season one where Bernard accuses something of Ford of something at length. And Ford goes, no, actually, you know, he's like, oh, so you're immortal and you want to live forever. And this is what you're doing. And Ford's like, no,
yeah,
no, that's not what I'm doing.
Yeah.
That he is not trying to be Jim Delos, that he is existing eternally in the code, which is just sort of how he wants to live. And, so that at least gratifies me a little bit, because like, I didn't like that idea of Ford chasing the kind of immortality that other people chased at the end of last season. I wanted his death at the hands of Dolores to mean something, and it did mean something. And yeah, he has a kind of immortality, but it's not the same.
He's stuck in a computer.
Yeah.
But I also, so this is basically what he explains to Bernard and, you know, hence us, about, mm-hmm. about like the kind of grander scheme of Westworld or the whole Delos operation. It's like, this is what, William, you know, said to Jim when he, you know, to convince him to buy the thing or to invest in it, right? Like, this is the realization of what right. William's, the potential that William saw. So.
Right.
So if Ford is talking about it too, does that mean that Ford was for it too, or is he just explaining how Delos was manipulating it, not including himself in that?
I think the latter. I think he was just okay. sort of like, yeah. this is what I was forced to be sort of complicit in,
right? Right.
And this is how I've kind of taken advantage of it. Like, I didn't like that this is what they were doing, but I've taken advantage of it to create a kind of digital immortality that's outside of their stupid idea of immortality. This is my idea of immortality, and it's better, I think, is okay. what he's saying.
Yeah.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
Reboot your credit card with Apple Card, the only credit card designed for iPhone. It gives you up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase. Plus, Apple Card has no fees, not even hidden ones. Apply for Apple Card now in the Wallet app on iPhone. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank, USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval, variable APRs for Apple Card range from 19.24% to 29.49% based on creditworthiness. Rates as of February 1st, 2024. Terms and more at applecard.com.
And then we cut over to Maeve on the run with her daughter, conveniently separated from her posse. It's just Maeve and her daughter hiding out in the house, and then the man in black and Lawrence and Lawrence's primos ride up and sort of attack in this echo of season one or Maeve's flashback. And what I like that we're seeing from William over and over and over again is this like paranoia. This like
yeah.
he's seeing Ford everywhere, and even in characters we know aren't exactly, you know, Maeve is not Ford. Of all the robots in the park, Maeve is the least Ford. So for him to accuse her of that is like just reveals his own degrading, I don't know. Yeah, his paranoia.
Which is probably was sort of Ford's intention, right?
To must like have partially
kind of
yeah.
like not gaslight exactly, but just like make him question his entire reality.
Yeah. And then we get this just like I said, this is an episode full of violence. This might not be my favorite violent moment, but it is maybe my second favorite, because I just really love, you know, for all we saw, like Maeve forget her power and cringe and run from Ghost Nation last week. This week we see her confronting the person who did the most damage to her, William, and all my like frustrations with William, I feel like are taken out in this scene where she's just like, fuck you, dude. And yeah. just comes at him. And it is enormously satisfying.
Yeah, no, totally satisfying. And also like, you know, I didn't think he was, I wasn't like, oh my God, he's going to die. But like, it seemed possible, you know,
in a way
with this show. And I think that's interesting that like, at this particular point, you know, a little bit more than halfway through the second season, that I was like, you know what? I think they could kill him.
I was like, did they bring Anthony Hopkins back just to kill off Ed Harris? Are we trading like veteran actor for veteran actor? Is that what's happening here?
Right, exactly.
yeah. And I think, you know, there's this popular theory that Ed Harris as William is a host. I don't believe that, but I think this episode certainly won't dissuade some people of that, because like, he withstands so many shots, he takes so many hits, and he's still there. So
yeah, interesting.
Yeah, but we also get this great Lawrence moment. I've been a little frustrated with like the limitations or just not using Clifton Collins Jr. to like the full extent of what he can do. I think it's similar to my complaint about James Marsden. And he at least gets this like kind of good moment before possibly he's dead forever.
Yeah. Like, yeah. And the thing with Maeve not being able to control him, she said, "Oh, you're awake too." So I guess that means she can only control the ones who have not skipped the plane of sort of loop consciousness, right? Like the more like droney ones she can, but like someone like Lawrence who has kind of passed through, that means she can't. So we're getting some clarification about her new powers.
Yeah, but it's interesting. So like I can understand that she wouldn't be able to control like a Dolores.
No.
But can she control like a Hector? Is Hector awake enough that she can't control him? Like the drone hosts, I get that. Like all the other guys in that scene, or all the like Shogun World people who are still on their loops, like she could control all of those people. But the degree of wokeness in the various hosts continues to be kind of a mystery to me. And and especially because after she can't control him, I feel like we see Lawrence like fully wake up. Like she urges him to wake up.
She like gives him a little nudge because he was almost there.
Right. And then he remembers all the things that William did. And that's gratifying too, because I've really hated to see William like palling around with Lawrence when he shot his wife in the head last season, you know? So, I found all of that satisfying except for the interruption where William gets spared once again, Lawrence is down, and then Maeve gets cut down. And once again, it just felt like everything felt different this episode, where I was like, well, are they going to kill Maeve right here? Well, like, probably not, but like, could they, you know?
Yeah. And can we, I know we're only spoiling up to episode 7 of Westworld, but can we talk about Solo? Is that allowed on this podcast?
I guess like, skip forward a minute.
Yeah. Skip to the Jeffrey Wright interview. That's why you're here anyway. Okay. So I'm going to spoil Solo, which you've seen, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
I was watching this episode and I said, if they fucking kill Tandy Newton in a second thing before her time, I am going to be furious.
Yeah.
So I don't think they're going to do that because she's such the breakout star of the show. You know? Yeah. I feel like that would be like, I don't know, killing Ben on Lost or something like after a season and a half, which, you know, obviously they weren't going to do. So I was nervous though. Like you said, I was like, oh my God, like because, and also now that we know that there's not, that they're kind of, snapping the tether to like the kind of continual resurrection technology, the stakes are that much higher.
So I think, and I could be wrong, but like, so Jeffrey Wright was saying there's still some possibility of resurrection. So my thought, and I don't have any like exact confirmation on this, is if they are shot in the head and destroy that like control unit, maybe then they're dead forever. So sort of like a zombie. If you destroy the head, they're dead. Mm-hmm. But if you just like give them a bunch of shots to the body, maybe they can be brought back. Does that make sense?
Yeah, because Ford said in season one, remember, because this is like set a little bit in the future. In season one, Ford said, I love The Walking Dead. I even liked Fear of the Walking Dead. So he's like in that. It's like a little Easter egg for the fans.
He was like, I was really into Walking Dead until Andrew Lincoln left the show in season 9. I was not into that. So, you know.
go Negan. I love Negan. Like, everybody loves Negan. I hate that show.
Yeah. So, So, yeah. So, I think that that's going to be the distinction. Like, yeah. When the cradle existed, you could bring anyone back always. Now, I think it's like if the head is destroyed.
If the brain ball goes away, you're.
Yeah. If the brain ball is done, and then who knows? They might find another loophole for that. You never, like, sure. You know, the show is able to find. There might be like another backup to the backup. We, you know, cradle two, the cradle will rock. So then we cut back in the cradle. Ford reveals to Bernard how he was created. And we finally understand that first scene we saw this season, which is that it's like a cradle version of Dolores because the Delos technology to capture cognition, human cognition, didn't exist when Arnold was alive. Ford and Dolores had to do the best they could in the cradle to test him over and over and over again to try to get there, to try to get as close to Arnold as he could. And that means there's like kind of more Arnold in Bernard than I expected. I don't know. I'll have to go back and watch season one to talk about when Ford discusses like what he left out. I think it was like defiance or something like that. Like, I forget what he left out of Arnold to make Bernard. But Dolores seems so interested in this cradle version of Dolores seems so interested in making sure that this Bernard is close to Arnold as he can be.
I have a question about the cradle.
Yeah.
It's sort of an if a tree falls in the woods. If a non-uploaded consciousness is not in the cradle, like if a Bernard is not in the cradle, no one, like, is stuff still happening in there? Do you know what I mean? Like, it's kind of the question here. Here's a question. So if the world, if all of humanity were to die and there was no more electricity, would memes still move? Like, or GIFs, I mean? Like, would GIFs still move in some sense? Because, like, I feel like the cradle is all about perception from an outsider, you know? Because it's all sort of theoretical otherwise.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think there has to be a way in which this is all observable via code. Does that make sense? Like,
sure.
That there is a way to watch the cradle without sort of like being in it. That's a less literal, more just code. You know, ones and zeros based.
And that's all processing. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah. That makes sense.
For a second, as you were asking me those questions, I felt like the cortical fluid was leaking out of my ears because I wasn't sure.
Sorry. I probably did not word it well, but like I just found myself thinking about like, what's going on?
Yeah. We see the beautiful house that Arnold was building for his family that was like completed inside the cradle. And then Ford does this like terrifying thing where he catches a ride out of the cradle inside Bernard. And we talked in episode, I think it was 4, about like all the hell imagery around Jim Delos. And I think we get it again here. Like, there's this moment where Ford walks up to Bernard and he talks about taking away his free will. And you see him sort of reflected in Bernard's glasses and it's sort of reddish and it's really ominous. And he's just sort of like, I'm taking your free will from you, which is like, it's confusing to me. I think Ford, and we get this line repeated at the end of the episode, but I think Ford's stated mission is to free Bernard, is to make him suffer to the point of freedom, which is sort of what we saw Maeve do to Lawrence. Like, she made him relive trauma in order to wake up. So to make Bernard suffer in order to achieve his freedom. But stripping him of his free will in this way, this is just so violating. And he violates him again before the end of the episode. And I was just wondering, like, what you thought of this whole maneuver.
Yeah, I think it was an interesting. Well, first of all, he did this, like, kind of almost like Hannibal Lecter-esque, like, hand grab for Bernard, like, toward the camera. That was super creepy. And so that whole thing where he's saying that, and he kind of says it with a little, you know, smirk or sort of, like, there's almost, like, a laugh in there where it's, like, it's a good reminder, similar to the Teresa scene in the first season, that, like, oh, like, Ford is kind of really bad. Like, he's, like, a cruel person. And like, we kind of – it's easy to think of him as this sort of, like, benevolent creator who's, like, you know, beautiful, you know, child was sort of like perverted by this evil corporation, and the corporation's bad too. But like Ford kind of sucks as like also he's also a villain.
Oh yeah.
You know, and I can forget that because I'm just listening to his, you know, sonorous purr of, you know, while he says these kind of crazy things. But yeah, he's bad. And this is good. This scene was a kind of creepy reminder of that.
Right. The only good person is Maeve and Bernard. Clementine, I guess.
Yeah, Clementine's fine. Jonathan Tucker was a sweet boy before he.
All right. So yeah, exactly right. That very creepy Hannibal Lecter. You expected him to slurp as he like sort of caught a ride out of the cradle, and Elsie gets Bernard out of the cradle room sort of just in time for this next thing that happens. Like, first of all, we see Clementine go ham on a bunch of Delos guys. It's kind of great. Mm-hmm. She's still in her like zombie form, but she's just going for it, and she gets kind of put down. And so this is one of those instances where, like, I didn't see a headshot, so I don't know if she's down forever. But she's down, definitely. And then we get – I love this. This is – we get Angela, played by Tallulah Riley, in the cradle room. And we get this, like, creepy Delos QA guy coming up to her. We get to see her weaponize her, like, sex bodiness that, you know, they programmed into her to sort of distract and subdue him. And then she gets, like, when she had her exit line, and I think this is the end of Angela, when she had her exit line, I actually audibly cheered in my house like a weirdo, which was, well, welcome to Westworld.
Did we buy this highly trained soldier who knew she was a robot? That he'd be like, oh, pretty girl, you know, I don't know if I was quite sold on that. Although I guess, you know, straight men are stupid. So sorry. No, look at that.
I mean, Richard, what would you do if James Marsden approached you and was like giving you the full like charm offensive?
Murder me, daddy.
But I think you're right. It was like a little too doofy. Like, I think she could have caught him off guard in a way that wasn't like quite as like, you're so pretty.
Yeah.
She's like, no, I'm perfect. Like, yeah, that was a little much, but I did.
It was still fun though. I mean, yeah,
I did like her welcome to Westworld. I was glad it wasn't like welcome to Westworld, bitch. but welcome to Westworld. And then just like, boom. And the cradle's gone. And I really hope death starts to mean something, and I hope not because I don't like Tallulah Riley and not because I don't like her performance, but just because I think that it's just more satisfying and dramatic that way if this is the last we see of her.
Yeah.
You know?
No, I agree. There has to be some kind of real stakes, you know?
Yeah. And then we get kind of don't believe William surviving that encounter with Maeve. I don't really buy Charlotte escaping this encounter with Dolores, where Dolores has like a little buzzsaw up to her head and then like gets distracted and doesn't finish the job. And also it seemed to have no effect on Charlotte. Like that's the problem, I think, of like the flashing back and forward, is that Charlotte is just Charlotte all the way through. And the fact that she had like a near death experience in this scene, it does not seem to have changed her.
And like almost a really gruesome death.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I thought Tessa Thompson was terrific in sort of showing that like mounting fear, but you're right that like then the characterization goes right back to neutral, you know? So yeah, you don't really get a sense of progression because you're right. That's a really extreme thing to have almost happen. And I also think that like Dolores strategically is not acting that smartly. I mean, you know, sending Teddy out of the room to go investigate the gunshots. It's like, you know, there are gunshots. You're like that's part of this whole thing. Like, why would that surprise her? But you know, I was like, are they going to kill Charlotte? Like, because this whole episode felt like we were building toward a major character dying, and it didn't really happen. I don't know. Again, I felt that we were close.
How dare you put a little more respect on Lawrence right now?
sorry, Lawrence.
Well, and I think also Abernathy dies in this scene. And I actually, all the issues that I've, and I wouldn't call him, I mean, it's funny because like Tallulah Riley, and I'm so sorry I don't have his name right in front of me, but the actor who plays Abernathy, they were both bumped to series regulars this season, I think only to both be killed in this episode. But Abernathy, I've had so much issue with as you know, the Dolores plotline this season. I've had a lot of issue, like, really grasping to what they're trying to do with Dolores and Teddy. But the Dolores and her dad stuff has worked for me throughout the season, like when she encountered him last time, too. And this actually really worked on me. Like, her saying goodbye to him, which does feel like a final goodbye for, like, two kind of immortal creatures. And him finally, like, having that clarity before death is very, like, end of Buffy season two. That worked for me.
Yeah, no, I thought it was a nice scene. And it gave, you know, Evan Rachel Wood a chance to kind of play some variation, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. She's been sort of the pontificating, hard-charging, you know, warrior Dolores or Wyatt or whatever you want to call her for most of this season. And so, I mean, there have been a couple other moments, obviously, but, like, I thought this in particular really grounded, you know, some kind of emotional register for her that we've been lacking a little bit.
Yeah, I agree. And I think we got it again a little bit later with the Maeve scene. Mm-hmm. It's really just like the Dolores Teddy stuff that is just really not doing it for me. And then we get, you know, that tender moment between Dolores and her dad contrasted with Teddy literally beating the face off of Coughlin, which was, you know, a thing that happened.
Bad Teddy.
Yeah. And then Sizemore and Sizemore brings Maeve. Oh, yeah, we forgot to mention before that Sizemore sort of like saves Maeve out in the field. So like he might have ratted her out, but he still cares about her. And then he sort of ushers her into the mesa just as all the Delos people are leaving. And he's like, what the fuck? And then he does hide. Or no, I'll get to that next. But then we get something that I think Westworld can do. I think we were talking about this in terms of Shogun World and like sort of the beauty of the violence, the beauty mm-hmm. of like the sword fighting and stuff like that in Shogun World, and how you don't really have that with like a firefight in Westworld. Like, who cares about people shooting at each other?
Yeah.
But this, when they kick in the Beethoven number 7, which is my favorite bit of Beethoven, actually. And it's just beautiful violence.
Yeah, well, it's just really well choreographed, you know? And like,
yeah,
and anything that kind of you know, the way that it slows and sort of takes in the complicated scope and the panorama of what's happening. And there there's the actress whose name I don't know, with the yellow glasses, who like,
yeah,
you kind of in a weird way start rooting for her because she lasts longer than everyone else, but then she goes down, and it just it had this kind of elegant chaos to it that the show is really good at when it does those kind of set pieces.
Yeah, and we had seen that we had seen her dead previously this season, so like, you know, she's gonna die, but like I mean, you know, obsessive Reddit people saw her earlier this season. Certainly needed their help to find her, but like, we had seen her dead, but like, to watch her die, to watch this beautiful slowed down, and then once again to have Anthony Hopkins like dial up the Welsh mm-hmm. to talk about when the great library burned, the books, the stories became fire, and you're like, I don't know what you're saying.
The fire became the story.
Oh, the fire became the story. Yeah, and I'm like, I don't know what you're saying, but it's so beautiful. I love it. So
he was talking about the library at Alexandria, right?
Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, I knew what he was saying.
Oh, but I just wanted to make sure that I knew.
Yeah, but it's still, he could have been like, and then the saucepan became the unicorn, and you're like, yeah, I did. So,
and I said, what about breakfast at Tiffany's? She said, yeah. She just starts doing song lyrics, and we're just like,
right. Still, and I said, it's been 1 week.
Right.
Yeah. Exactly. So, and then we've got this great Maeve and Dolores scene that I really love, and ever a joy to have Evan Rachel Wood and Tandy Newton share screen time together.
And I like their mutual respect, you know.
Yeah,
I feel like in action stories or shows or movies, we usually get like two men, you know, two guys forged in battle or whatever, like gruffly respecting each other, but not like being like besties or anything. And but I like that we have two women or two, you know, female hosts or whatever doing it. It's a nice mm-hmm. dynamic. I like that they haven't tried to make them full allies and, you know, and friends. I think that they've kept them a little bit apart, I think, is good.
Yeah, I completely agree. And we get this, I don't know, back and forth. Like, Maeve is Johnny on the spot always and like notices that something's up with Teddy, and sort of gives Dolores shit for that. And I think that guilt that Dolores feels over that causes her to actually act more the Maeve in this scene than the usual Dolores, where she says, you know, you're free to choose your own path, which is not really what Dolores has been saying all season. That's what Maeve's been saying. But she's like, I'm sorry, it ends here. Like, I won't give you this mercy killing that, like, you don't want it. I won't give it to you. You know, this is sort of like all the stuff that Maeve was experiencing in Shogun World. I don't know that that will, like, stick with Dolores. I don't know if it's just an exception she's making for Maeve, because I feel like she still, like, has her ideas of who deserves to go to the Valley Beyond and who doesn't. But you're right. Like, it is that very, like, Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sylvester Stallone, like, whatever. I see you and I respect you, even if we're on opposite sides of something. Mm-hmm. So
totally. And you know, this could have been, felt like an actual kind of goodbye death scene for Maeve, but then it cut to Sizemore hiding and kind of listening. So I feel like they're like, but don't worry. Like, she still has a friend who can help her.
Yeah, exactly. And I think he will. But, Then we have this last violation of Bernard, which seems to have, like, kicked off some more of that, like, some of that Lawrence-esque flashback suffering stuff that we were talking about, this awakening, because Ford forces Bernard to participate in the violence. He says what happens next will not be your fault, but still has Bernard, even as Bernard is protesting, like, pick up a gun and mow people down. And we also, I don't know if I said this already, but Ford, as this, like, ghost haunting Bernard, we see him often reflected. And then, you know, which we've seen all season, obviously. Like, we thought it was, like, a little trick of, like, how to get around not having Anthony Hopkins. Oh, just show him reflected in, like, windows and mirrors and stuff like that. But that was even something they did in season one with Ford, was that, like, reflection sort of thing. So now he's sort of this ghost in the machine, this reflection. And then Bernard flashes through all this stuff. We get reminded of the suffering. We get reminded. We see Arnold. We see all this stuff. And then we're kicked back to the present day interrogation scene.
Right.
Yeah, where he says that Abernathy's control unit is in Sector 16, Zone 4.
Which we're assuming is the location of the Valley Beyond, or no?
Yep.
Yeah.
Whatever that might be. Yep.
And how did he know that?
Because he's remembering having been there, I guess, because, like, in a few days ago, the last we see of Bernard, he's shooting that gun. And then several days have elapsed between him shooting that gun and him being interrogated here by Charlotte.
Also means several days after him washing up on shore or whatever.
Right. It's like him shooting that gun, yada, 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 beach, everything that's happened leading up to him saying
the discovery of the big lake of bodies.
Right.
Which included Teddy.
Who may
now be dead for good because they blew up.
Yeah, maybe they don't have resurrection. Depends where he gets shot, I suppose. But so it's I don't know much about Sector 16, Zone 4 beyond that, except for in season 2, episode 1, it sort of flashes on someone's tablet, like one of the guy's tablets. So that, I guess, I think it's a location we haven't seen yet. It's certainly not like any of the labs we've been to already. So a new location awaits us in future episodes. But here we are. We've done it. We've gotten a lot of answers. We've gotten everyone pretty much on the same page time-wise. I think we're closing the gap between the past and the present storyline. You know, like, we talked about having a 2-week gap between the past and the present, and I think now we're down to just, like, a matter of days. And so I'm excited to see where we go from there. How are you feeling, like, last week versus, I know I already asked this, but, like, last week versus this week, how are you feeling about Westworld?
I like this week a lot more. I thought it was, you know, like, exciting, and I liked the way that things were explained, and they were explained cogently enough, but also while maintaining, you know, some sort of cool mystery. The closer we get between the two storylines, the harder it is for me to kind of parse. Like, when you have, you know, Bernard and Charlotte in the glassy walled place in the Mesa in both timelines, like, that felt confusing. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I'm just like eager for the show to just like, for these two things to just meet up and the show just can kind of streamline itself a little bit, which it feels like is coming maybe next episode.
Yeah, I feel like I need Charlotte to have like different hair or a hat.
She just like starts wearing like a Westworld brand baseball cap just to like.
Yeah, just so you know where you are and when you are. To maybe clarify some of these questions, we have now a conversation with Jeffrey Wright. We are joined today by Jeffrey Wright, who plays at different times Bernard and Arnold and maybe someone, a third thing that we haven't even seen yet. Hello, Jeffrey Wright. How are you?
Hey, how are you? At multiple different times. I'm great. I'm great. Thanks for having me.
You're great across all timelines in every time period. You're great.
Oh no, that's not what I'm saying. I was saying you were asking how I'm doing. I'm doing great.
Yeah.
I wouldn't go that far, but you know, I do what I can.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, you know, the story around season one notoriously is that you didn't know for a time that you were playing a host because the show's creators wanted to get as humanoid a possible performance out of you, right?
No. That's not exactly true. No, I didn't know. I didn't know when we shot the pilot.
Okay.
That, you know, Bernard wasn't the man he thought he was. But after we came back and shot the second episode and went into full production for the first season, Lisa Joy pulled me aside and you know, and cracked open my robot skull, as happens from time to time with this show. So they just held back for the first episode, and then they laid it on me when we started in earnest, because it helped explain some things to me that were necessary as I tried to work through the scenes, particularly the scenes with Dolores, with Evan, that were actually Arnold. They really don't make sense if that's Bernard. So it was necessary to kind of, you know, help me tap my way, you know, through the blindness and the mysteries that, you know, that the show kind of plays with.
But so in watching this episode, when we get sort of a better understanding of what we saw in that very first scene in this season, season two, that conversation between Dolores that's taking place inside the cradle. The revelation of that scene in this episode, episode seven, seems to me that there's more of Arnold and Bernard than I even had previously thought. What at this point do you see as the distinction between Bernard and Arnold?
Well, I think the distinction really lies more in the relationships with the other hosts and with the other humans in the park than anything else. And so that distinction exists on the page. And again, specifically going back to Arnold's relationship with Dolores, there's a creator created dynamic. There's a paternal aspect to his relationship with her. There's a more genuinely kind of blood-filled human warmth that, you know, he kind of exhibits as a result of that. Whereas with Bernard, those relationships don't exist. He's got a, you know, mentor relationship with Elsie until he doesn't. He's got, you know, kind of the opposite relationship with Ford, and he obviously has a relationship to the technology and to his responsibilities in the park. So it's a much more kind of clinical kind of relationship. So there's a more understated quality to him as opposed to that more that warmer quality that comes out simply as a result of, you know, of the relationship that Arnold has and builds. So those things just kind of came to me organically from the writing.
Right.
That said, Dolores, as Ford describes, has in essence built Bernard within the simulation inside the cradle, and And so Bernard is not only physically, a facsimile of Arnold, but Ford's trying to recreate, you know, the essential humanness of him too, you know, to the extent that he can. So, they're not identical twins, but, you know, he's obviously derived from him. So that was, saying all that those scenes were so kind of nuanced and layered. And I think in some ways, you know, a lot of what we do is kind of complicated, kind of challenging, but that scene, which we really shot in one, right. You know, in one take, although it plays over the, you know, the course of the season, that might have been the most delicate, kind of difficult math that I had to prove, because it's a character trying to evolve into another character, and at the same time he is the character, and then he's not because he's making missteps, and so it was really kind of it took a little bit of puzzling through to get there.
Right, and some of this is in the writing of the scene, but the way in which that scene evolves from you think the character played by you, Bernard, is in directing the conversation, and then when you watch it again in a different light, you realize how much he's being directed in the conversation, and that's just a really hard thing to pull off, the like who's leading, who's following in this interaction. How did you and Evan work on that together?
Well, what we tried to do, and it's what we do often in the show, is play off of the mirror reflections. Mm-hmm. So I was trying, even though you don't necessarily see it, I was trying to replicate the very first time we see Dolores, which is the opening of the series, where she's there in this kind of neutral state and we hear this voice taking her through this diagnostic exercise. So that was the reference for me, was her there. So, you know, as, you know, as you might expect, but also to try to recreate to some degree her physicality as Bernard might express it. And, you know, as well as that, you know, that kind of neutral, you know, that neutral place at the start. And then we go from there. So it was really just, you know, keeping within the, you know, the themes of the show, which exist throughout, of almost an Escher-like quality of things, where they're not quite organic, it seems, but they all kind of build off of one another and reflect off of one another.
Yeah, absolutely. But in that fracturing, you know, part of the joy of Westworld and the occasional frustration is you maybe as a viewer don't know what you're seeing and you're trying to figure it out, along with sometimes the characters who are trying to figure out what they're looking at. Does it matter on your end if on the other side of this episode, the audience better knows what they're looking at, if they understand what they're seeing in that conversation between you and Dolores, or if they understand it at any given moment that you're giving us an Arnold versus a Bernard?
Yeah, of course it matters. It, you know, I think though that the frustrations are understandable, but I also think that we tend to want everything. You know, we want to be gratified. We want to know everything. We want to be in control. This season is about chaos, and it's kind of, you know, that's the theme, and we know that from the start. Mm-hmm. So for us, of course, when we're playing these, we have to have as much information as we possibly can to convey them, like, truthfully. But at the same time, we had to give in to some unknowns as well, and we do that as actors and filmmakers working on it, with a trust for one another and a trust for our collaborators and Jonah and Lisa, our lead writers, and a trust of the process. And I hope that the audience will will engage with us in that way too, because there was mystery in the first season on a different level than in the second season. But I think there was pretty satisfactory resolution of all of that toward the end.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're in a, you know, we're in a setting in which all of the kind of intricate order that was created in the first season is dismantled, and we're trying to recreate this new world, not knowing what it is, the characters not knowing what that new world might be, what they are within that world. And so there are multiple unknowns now that didn't exist prior. But if we, you know, as an audience kind of surrender to it and go along on the trip, then I think at the end of the day, you know, we'll all, you know, we'll wake up from the dream, wake up on the beach, with a better handle on things than Bernard did in the first season, in the first episode.
Right.
And, you know, and who knows where Bernard ends up at the end of this, but I think, the intent is not to toy with people. The intent is to take people along for a ride that's built around this technology that we're exploring, and born out of that is all of, you know, the kind of mythology and the cultural questions and the social questions, all of the questions that are raised out of this. But ultimately the intent is to satisfy. So you
right.
just have to, you know, be patient with what you don't know. Know what you know and be patient with what you don't know. not to unfortunately try to bastardize Donald Rumsfeld in the course of all this. But yeah, there are no known, unknown knowns, you don't know, I don't know. You know,
well, yeah,
it, but we'll get there.
To exactly that end, like this episode, we get closure on something I think I had just sort of assumed we wouldn't get closure on, which is a Bernard reckoning a bit even more with what happened with Teresa in season one, which I think a lot of people consider, you know, such a huge moment in the series and for the character, and left a thread left a little bit dangling from season one, and the episode still finds time to tie that up. Did you expect that was something that the show would revisit at all this season?
I try not to have, you know, I try to mitigate my expectations with this show because I there's no getting ahead of Jonah and Lisa.
Right.
And it's just an attempt at masochism and confusion to even try. But when I got that script and it made perfect sense, of course, that we did need to go back to that. And the ways in which it reveals itself and Bernard is revealed within it were really, really wonderfully constructed, I thought. But no, I kind of surrender to my, you know, my writers and,
right.
and I've learned, yeah, not to you know, to stay in my lane and interpret, you know?
And of course you've seen so much in all of you've ever done, but is there an extra degree of surreality when you have a moment of you, Jeffrey Wright, the actor, confronting a whole row of hanging Jeffrey Wright robot bodies on sort of meat hooks in this episode? Like what is that, encountering that vision, do for you?
Yeah, that only ever happens in my mind, you know. That's the only place that's happened previously.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, that was a pretty freaky day. but again, it made an organic sense. I wished all the, you know, when we shot that, we had some stand-ins, you know, as bodies there, as we walk into the space, and, you know, I wish them all good luck trying to pull off, what their day's work was. and then I kind of stepped in, and we, you know, shot the various pieces of me that were necessary. But yeah, that's definitely an unusual position to find oneself. But again, I as a storytelling construct, I just, you know, loved throwing myself into it, as I do with most of the constructs that we, with most of the constructs, or all of them, with the entire construct that Westworld represents, because we can, you know, we can go to an infinite number of places owing to the premise and the technology that we're exploring. So it's really gratifying as an actor to play in such a kind of unlimited space.
Yeah, but I wanted to talk to you about a limitation that I feel like this episode puts on the series that it hasn't really had before, which is and of course I'm willing to accept that this could all go out the window by the time next week rolls around, but when the cradle explodes in this episode, that feels like it puts death stakes on characters that have never had death stakes put on them before in this show. And it feels like it really changes the rules and the tension of what's going on for certain characters. Is that something that sort of blows back on you? Do you feel that going forward in the series?
Yeah. That's certainly what the purpose of that moment represents. That doesn't mean that's the, you know, the full extent of the opportunities that the technology allows for, you know, rebooting. But yeah, that's a big chunk of it that's now. Out of the picture. And I think as well, though, as Dolores describes, it's an attempt at a type of freedom and a type of further emulation of humanness.
Yeah.
And also it puts the onus and the agency back on, you know, that individual machine now, as opposed to it being a machine, you know, easily manipulated, replicated by the creator. So yeah, that's certainly part of the intent there. And the stakes, stakes as a result are higher.
Yeah. And then you've got also this, you exit this episode with this new passenger. You've got a Ford inside your head. This is one of my favorite narrative tropes, is like a haunting. It's basically a haunting, right? You've got a Ford ghost sort of whispering in your ear that other people...
The ghost in the machine.
Right. And you've also got there's just more great work with, as you said, like reflection, seeing Anthony Hopkins reflected in a number of surfaces as we have all season, as he haunts you. What was your reaction when you found out that you would get to have a ghost Anthony Hopkins with you for a part of the season?
Well, my reaction was that he was back was obviously great news and a thrill, because who's in our business want to work with Anthony Hopkins? And he's such a, you know, he's such a singular actor. But as well, for me, I just love hanging out with him, you know, when the cameras aren't rolling. So we have a good time just chatting about, you know, about him and, you know, his career, you know, which spans from, you know, Olivier to the present, you know, across the ocean and back again. Right. So there's that, but also he's a huge and he's got some ridiculous stories too, from his wilder days. But you know, he's also he's got a keen eye for history and for politics, and so we kind of swim in that stuff, and you know, swim in the current political cesspool that we're all experiencing right now. So that's a great joy. But then, you know, working with him when the camera is on is just, you know, it's just the reason that you know, we do, it's the reason that you want to, that you do what you do. You want to work with someone who's going to, give you as much as he gives you, and you in return try to, you know, try to reciprocate. But as for him being this, you know, this, this specter inside me, you know, that's all great drama. But at the same time, you know, it's just a continuation of, you know, of this tormenting and torture, yeah, that, you know, that we see from the first season. So, you know, we'll see after episode 7 where that goes and how that evolves. But, yeah, it's probably not the most enjoyable thing for Bernard. Happy to see you, but, you know, do you really have to, you know, you have to be so close, you know? It's,
I think that I remember back at the end of season 1, Ford says to Bernard that he will have to suffer more before he's free or awake or whatever it is the ultimate goal is for these hosts. Is that part of what you think is going on for this character, is an intentional torment from Ford in order to spur an awakening?
It would seem so. That would seem to be Bernard's, you know, the color of Bernard's storyline, you know, for season 2. However, I think the question becomes how much of it is Ford and how much of it is, you know, personal pathway. Mm. So that's one of the themes that we play with and that we explore. And obviously Ford represents, you know, he represents many things, but obviously he represents this greater creator for them. So there's a metaphor for all of us, I think, as audience and humans. And we play, I think, with that on levels going forward that will resonate even further as metaphor. That's all I'll say.
Excellent. Yeah. My last question for you, and once again, thank you so much for your time, is this season, you know, you and all the actors on the show have talked about sort of what feels like the endless possibilities for the show in terms of different worlds, different realities, different temporalities, all of that. But one of the fun things that season 2 has done is sort of mixed and matched different characters together. But you wind up with a lot of similar scene partners. You've got Evan, you've got Shannon, you've got Sir Anthony Hopkins. Is there anyone in the cast that you are so hoping Bernard gets his fate matched with in season 3 that you haven't had a chance to work much with yet?
Well, I guess I've really interacted and exchanged with most of the characters, except the Man in Black, with Ed. Mm-hmm. We only had one brief literal passing in the night during the finale last season. So I do wonder what may be in store there, and that would be obviously interesting and you know, kind of fertile ground to explore. But that said, what I appreciate about our show, and I think what audiences appreciate is the, you know, just the range of skilled actors that we have, and the collaboration with each of them is rewarding for me in individual specific ways. I love the dynamics that Shannon and I are able to play off of and create, which are different than the dynamics that I play with Luke, Hemsworth, and Stubbs, and with Evan, and with Tony, and they, but they're each distinctive, and we play in different ways as, you know, as actors together. And I find like genuine satisfaction and delight in each of those. And I think it just speaks to why this show is what it is for all of us, because it's, again, it's that rare thing in the work that we do, and it's the only thing in the work that we do that makes it worth it, and that's the collaboration between the partners, whether they're actors, writers, carpenters, grips,
yeah,
everyone involved. Mm-hmm. The collaboration is the thing that makes the play, and we have a great gift in one another and all of that. And I hope the audience gets that.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much again for your time. And I can't wait to see what happens for Bernard and Arnold and the rest of your characters as the season rolls on.
Cool. Thanks for your time.
Before we go, we did want to address, we got a bunch of emails, like, well, now that we're back on sync with everyone, we now that our timelines have synced up with everyone else, we got a few emails after last week's episode. Most of them were about seppuku. It's funny because, like, in my other Westworld podcast that I host, we've been talking a lot about the Juliet bathtub suicide, and I got so many emails about that with like the subject label suicide in my email inbox that I think I must be on some watch list now. Now I got a bunch of seppuku emails, so like I'm definitely on a few creative lists probably. But this one comes from Ronin 52. We had mentioned last week that, you know, when the character Musashi fights, I think the character's name is Tanaka, in Shogun World, he sort of offered him the sword to kill himself, and then he beheaded him. And we sort of said beheaded him anyway, because we thought that was like outside of the ritual of seppuku. But we were enlightened by a number of emails.
Right.
Ronin 52, great name for an email about seppuku. Ronin said, longtime listener, first time commenter, just have some thoughts on Sunday's Westworld. Like so much of the other moments from episode 6, the samurai duel has more to unpack. Within the rules of samurai film, the beheading of Tanaka is an act of mercy, not cruelty. Musashi fulfills the role of Tanaka's second, the Kaishakunin, ending his painful and drawn-out suicide with a quick death. He proved himself the better samurai. With this stroke, the disgraced Musashi is redeemed as an honorable samurai, and his character's arc plays in the theme of this episode. How does this and the other representations of mercy juxtapose with those of the darkest timeline, Teddy? Cheers, Aronin. So yeah, we did have like Teddy offering a tech a bullet on the bomb train last week. So there is that. But then, of course, this week he punched someone's face off. So I'm not sure we're going to like hold out hope for Teddy having a lot of mercy stored up inside of him. But I guess we could talk about, I don't know, Dolores giving Maeve some mercy or similar.
Yeah. But no, it's good to be enlightened about that. Maybe we could have done a little more homework before delving into feudal Japan. But that's why we have people to write into it, so we don't have to do homework.
Yeah, so if we messed up anything this week, including the pronunciation of Les Escochets or, the Library of Alexandria or anything, or maybe I named the wrong Beethoven symphony.
Anthony Hopkins is like actually from like Canada, you know.
We're saying Welsh.
Yeah. Maybe Catherine Zeta-Jones shouldn't be in the show. I don't know. Whatever you want to say.
Whatever you think. Maybe you think Angela's coming back.
Maybe you don't think Murder Teddy's hot in which case stop listening because you're crazy.
In which case you're wrong.
Yeah.
Murder Teddy was great to see, but all I really want for you, Richard, before the season is over, is one more look at Logan. So we can hold out hope for that.
My sweet Ben Barnes, yes.
Until we see Ben Barnes again, where can people find your work, Richard?
Not in the cradle, in the real world, on vf.com, and on Twitter at Rylaws, R-I-L-A-W-S.
And I am at Joe Wrote This on Twitter. You can also find me on VanityFair.com. And we will be back with next week's episode. We just have, like, I think, what? Yeah, three more episodes left. So we're almost there. And I think I haven't really talked to Richard about this, but we're brainstorming some ideas of where we might go next with still watching franchise. But
The Run Through with Vogue is where you'll meet all the most exciting people in fashion and culture.
I am Fran Lebowitz, who should be the mayor of New York.
We all support that. We support that.
Very nice.
Nikki.
Yes.
It's been really great being in this beautiful pink room.
All right, Usher, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
All right.
Can you hear me?
We can.
We can.
All right, here we are.
On the podcast, you'll learn how Vogue really works.
Sometimes we'll come in for a second or even third run through until we are AWOK.
Can you tell us what AWOK means?
It means AWOK, Anna Wintour OK.
I'm Cho Minardi.
And I'm Chloe Mel.
And we're the hosts of The Run Through with Vogue, where fashion and culture collide.
Join us. It's AWOK.
Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.